Hey, podcast listeners. I've been doing this project for about 2 years now, and it feels like it might be time to bring the podcasting part of it to a close. The time that it takes to record and edit and upload comes out of my practice time, and that's feeling more and more precious. If you would miss this podcast, and if you'd like it to continue, please write a review for me in iTunes, not just stars, but an actual review. If I have 100 reviews in iTunes by the end of 2012, I'll continue this podcast in 2013. But if not, I'll end it then and use the time to practice. Thanks a lot. You're listening to Play It Again, Swig. I'm Jocelyn Swigger, and I'm trying to learn all the Chopin etudes. I'm also trying to balance hanging out with my toddler, teaching full-time, and life's other distractions. This is my audio diary of that process. Well, it's Saturday, December 1st, and let me start by saying that I know, if there are any grammar nerds out there listening, I know that demi, semi, penultimate is not really a word, and of course I know that anti-penultimate would be a better way to start building that ridiculous construction, but I thought it would be sort of a cute nod to the whole hemi, demi, semi, quaver way that the Brits talk about 16th notes and 32nd notes and 64th notes and all those. So what I mean by this ridiculous semi, demi, semi, penultimate word that I can't even say is that it looks like there will be only 3 podcasts after today. I have 16 reviews in iTunes so far. That's 16, not 60. And I need 100 reviews by midnight December 20th, or December 21st will be the last Play It Again, Swig podcast. So if that is distressing to you, and if you would really miss this podcast, please write me a review and maybe get a couple friends to write reviews. It's time for this to either have a larger audience or for me to be able to take this one day a week where I spend doing the podcast rather than practicing and to take that back and practice. So thank you so much to those of you who've written in. I really, really appreciate your comments. And if you would like to do a review, please do that by midnight December 20th. Okay, so I'm going to sort of talk at you quite a bit before I play, but I'll do quite a bit of playing today as well. I've been thinking a lot about practicing between practice and how important that is. And I mean that kind of on the large scale, like the idea that sort of lots of things you do in your life can make you a better musician and a better artist, if you're sort of thinking about them that way. And also that the moments in between practicing each little thing are really important. You know, if you play the same thing, sort of mindlessly repeating it a bunch of times, that doesn't really help. But if you play it and then you really set your intentions about the next time you're going to play it and then you play it, that moment in between is very important. So a couple of things about that I wanted to just sort of tell you about. One is that, you know, I've been saying forever, and forever meaning the last couple of months I'm being overdramatic, but I've been saying for a while that I intend to spend 3 minutes stretching at the beginning of my practice. And I've kept not doing it. I think it's that I sort of can't wait to practice, and I'm spending 2 minutes at the beginning meditating in the last few months, and I think that's really important and helpful. But I think I kind of feel like, okay, I'm 2 minutes just sitting here, and I want to practice. I just want to start practicing. But this week I actually did, like, I forced myself to stretch, and I did the stretching before the meditating, so I wouldn't be quite as impatient. Because I'm terrible at meditating, I should tell you. I mean, I do it, but I certainly have lots of thoughts come into my head. It's hard to get my attention back to my breathing. Anyway, so I did actually make myself stretch this week, and it's such a huge help. You know, maybe this is a correlation, not causation thing, but the days that I stretched this week, I had this really wonderful feeling of openness in my shoulders, and especially of my left arm really being able to play freely and feel really good. And boy, that's a terrific feeling. Now, maybe I would have had that without stretching, but I think the stretching helped. So my favorite stretch, let me try to describe this for you, is where you walk up against a wall as though you had walked into it like a cartoon character, and then put your arm up. So you're facing the wall, sort of smashed up against it. And then you put your arm up like you're waving hi to somebody. And then you, with your arm sort of pressed against the wall, you stretch your torso out. So it stretches the shoulder that's attached to the arm. And boy, that's a really good one. So I've been doing that one for a couple of minutes, and then a couple of minutes of the yoga pose, downward facing dog, which I won't explain. You either know it or you can find it. And it just feels really great. So even though I'm impatient to start practicing, that's really important and really worth doing. But I've also been thinking about this because I've been spending a lot of time away from the piano this week. It's a really stressful time of the semester. I mean, I know that the holidays are coming, and so that puts stresses on everybody. But for those of us who are living by the academic calendar, things are pretty crazy right now. And so I've been spending a lot of time at the computer, partly because I'm putting together this PowerPoint presentation I'll tell you about in a minute. But it's been making me just think about life away from the piano and having to be away from the piano. So I just wanted to tell you a couple of other things. One is, and I know everybody knows this, but it's so hard to make it happen, just like it can be so hard to make myself stretch. Sleep really helps you learn. You know, you need to get enough sleep so that your brain can process all the information you put into it. And actually, if you just have a short amount of time before a performance, like if you have 3 weeks and you really need a month and a half, one way you can double your practice time is by practicing a couple of hours in the morning and then taking a nap and then practicing a couple of hours in the evening, rather than just doing, you know, 4 hours in one big chunk. That really helps. Unfortunately, my schedule right now doesn't permit napping, and I know probably many of yours don't either. But if it does, you should consider it because it helps a lot. Another thing is that even though I'm spending so much time at the computer, I got rid of my office chair and I sit on a big Pilates ball just to kind of keep my core engaged and keep my balance going and not horribly slump all the time. And then I was also thinking about some of the things we can sort of intentionally do away from the piano that make our piano playing better. I have a student who is, I guess she's a sophomore, not a piano major, but takes lessons, who's just this beautiful young woman, but I don't think she knows it, which is actually great because it means she's put all of her energy towards being a really interesting, intelligent, kind person. It's going to be kind of cool when she discovers that she's beautiful as well, but she hasn't made that discovery yet. Anyway, part of her not knowing that she's beautiful, and it may have other things too, is that her shoulders are always forward. So she has this kind of slouch going on. And of course, that leads to all of this tension and discomfort. And so I told her in the last couple of weeks, I said, you know, you need to practice having your shoulders be back and having your heart be open, which is something they talk about in yoga. You know, they have all these heart opening poses. And it kind of sounds like a cheesy metaphor, but it actually really is opening up the front of your chest. I said, you know, you need to be doing this all the time, not just the piano. Whenever you're walking around, you always need to be thinking about what are my shoulders doing? And it really made a difference in her piano playing this week. It was really exciting to see. Like she looks like a totally different person, but also it's just much better. You know, I walk to work, which is it's a wonderful thing about my life. I'm really lucky that I can do that. And I really do try every morning when I'm walking to work and every evening when I'm walking back home, I try to use that walk to make sure that my core is engaged and that my shoulders are where I want them and that my neck is where I want it and that I feel good in my body instead of just kind of allowing myself to hunch forward. That's an important thing. I think it helps me as a pianist in addition to just helping me in my life. And one of the things that I told my student that I thought you might like hearing about is that I actually spent an entire summer walking everywhere that I went. I was at Chautauqua Summer Institute, so it really was walking. I was walking everywhere. Every time I had to walk somewhere, I would have my Henley paperback Beethoven Volume 2 edition on my head. So I really did spend a summer walking with Beethoven on my head, and it did a lot for my posture. It just really was important. So those are a couple kind of physical things about that you can sort of make your piano playing or your music playing better, even if you're not actually able to be at the piano all the time. Another thing I've been thinking about is you know, on this podcast, I haven't talked that much about being a parent, because I really wanted this to be a music practicing podcast and not a my life as a mommy podcast. But of course, you know, my life as a mommy has been a really huge, 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 huge part of what all is going on, which is why I have the little sound of my kid at the beginning and end. So, you know, I sometimes think that some of my experiences with my kid have been some of my most important musical moments in the last couple of years. One is, and I wanted to tell you about a couple of deliberate things with that. One is that I, of course, sing to him all the time. And when I started singing lullabies to him, one of the lullabies that I sing to him is Our Love is Here to Stay. I don't remember if that's Cole Porter or Gershwin or who, but it's one of those guys. And I deliberately decided I was going to use this song for myself as an etude to work on my rushing. You know how people are rushers or draggers? I'm definitely a rusher. You can hear it even in my speech. And so, of course, the way I think of the song is, it's very clear, our love is here to stay, not for a year, but ever and a day. But when I sing to my kid, I'm really, really careful to sing it slower than I want to, and to take longer pauses at the end of the phrases than I want to, because my tendency in my playing, if I don't really work on it, is to not put big enough pauses in. So I've been singing it more like, it's very clear, our love is here to stay, not for a year, but ever and a day, and so forth. And it remains to be seen how much that's helped my playing, but I do feel like I'm less likely to completely eat the spaces between phrases than I used to be. And I figured while I was singing to you, like I sing to my kid, I might share a thing that I sort of think is hilarious right now. We end up singing all of these songs, and there was a whole diaper changing medley. There still kind of is, but that now is morphing into a potty training medley. This is, you see why this hasn't been a My Life as a Mommy podcast. I swear I'll get to Chopin and music in a minute. But I thought that it might be amusing for you. Actually, you know what? It might be amusing for you to hear a potty training song. But you let me know. Write a review on iTunes. And if you want to hear the potty training song, I will sing the potty training song next week. It's not quite safe for work, but I'll warn you about that. So that's on you. If you want to hear the potty training song, let me know. Okay. So in addition to these Chopin etudes, another thing that's kind of taking my energy is I have a student performance on Monday. I'm teaching a class about stage fright, conquering stage fright, and about stage presence, which of course is the class that I always wished I could take when I was younger, but it wasn't offered. So we're doing a final showcase performance, and I'm accompanying all the students. And I thought it might be interesting to talk to you about a couple of those things. One is that I have a student playing the Brahms E minor, the first movement of the Brahms E minor cello sonata, which is so nice because it's an old friend. I love this piece. It was one of the first pieces that got me really excited about accompanying when I was an undergraduate. This is the one. I'll just play you the tune and then a little bit of it. This is this thing. Oops. And then the cello goes, and I'm not going to be able to sing this in the range, but just bear with me. Da, da, oops. Da, 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 da. I can't sing it. I'm going to leave it. It's just moving around ranges. It doesn't work for me. Anyway, this is this nice in accompanial part. Anyway, so that's really fun to play. And I'm not actually honestly practicing it a ton because I'm in triage mode with the time of the semester, but it's really, really nice to have that be a piece I'm playing. I have another student who is playing, I don't only have cellists, but I thought I'd tell you about this Lalo Concerto for Cello and Piano. I don't know if I've talked very much about playing orchestral reductions on here or not. I may not have, but I thought it might be worth mentioning that your job when you play an orchestral reduction is not to play every note that's written on the page. It's to sound like the orchestra. So, for example, there's a lot of times when you'll have octaves written, especially in the left hand in an orchestral reduction, and it just means that the cellists are playing and the basses are playing an octave lower. But a lot of times you could work really hard, you know, it can turn it into quite a difficult thing, or let me say, it can turn it into a thing that one has to practice rather than a thing that one can just sight read. And so if you, or one has to practice a lot rather than sight reading and practicing a little bit. So if you bear in mind that your job is to sound like the orchestra, not to play every single note that's put on the page. That makes everything a lot better. So I just thought I'd show you the very beginning, this orchestral opening to this Lalo Cello Concerto, and show you what I mean with that. So what's written is octaves on the right hand and single notes in the left hand. So the right hand is, and the left hand is. Now, I can play that, but it's a little bit tricky, especially this little jump. And frankly, it's just not a priority to practice that and make sure it's going to be just solid. You know, it's not a priority to practice those octaves. So instead, listen to this. I don't think there's anybody in the world who would hear that and say, oh, I really wish she were playing the octaves on the right hand. And if they would say that, then I'm not really interested in playing for them. So the idea is that you want to play super musically with lots of conviction and direction and sound like the orchestra rather than feeling like you're a slave to the notes on the page. That can be a really, really freeing thing. And it maybe translates to playing other music too, right? Where the idea is that the most important thing is to play the music and the notes are just a vehicle for that. So I thought I'd show you that. And then I thought I would tell you one more thing about this, these little other pieces that I'm practicing, which I just thought was kind of funny. I broke a rule for a student. I have had a pretty stringent no Hindemith rule, really for about 8 years. I've had a no Hindemith rule. Hindemith, if you don't know, it was a German composer, brilliant theorist, although kind of nutty in his own way, who had a beautifully firm grasp of counterpoint, but his music is generally pretty ugly. And he wrote sonatas for, it was either every instrument or almost every instrument, but there's this whole slew of sonatas for instrument plus piano, like tuba plus piano, bassoon plus piano, trombone plus piano, viola plus piano. There's all these pieces that are sonata for instrument plus piano. And the piano parts are always really, really hard and not very satisfying to work on. And, you know, I don't have a problem, as you know from my working in the Chopin Etudes, I don't have a problem working on hard music. And I actually don't even have a problem working on ugly music sometimes, but I have a really big problem working with hard music that is also ugly and unsatisfying. So I've had a big no Hindemith rule, and I broke it because I have a student in my class who really wanted to play the first movement of the clarinet sonata, which my colleague, who is our staff accompanist, who unfortunately has to play Hindemith much more than I do, he says that the clarinet sonata is actually the best one, that because it actually does have some pretty melodies in it. But I thought I would tell you, just because I thought it was really funny, I did a distraction performance for them in class last week, where each person had to get up and perform, and then I came up with some sort of distraction to happen so that they would have to keep their focus on stage. And they were things like, I had somebody open up a bag of Cracker Jacks and eat Cracker Jacks really loudly. I had a couple people in the audience pretend to get into a whispered fight. At one point, I had somebody throw a paper airplane back and forth. Ridiculous and hopefully situations that mostly won't happen in real performance. But the idea was to have people really keep their focus. So what I did for the student who was playing the clarinet sonata, and she did beautifully, she just kept right on going, was I took the pages, she had given me Xeroxes of the music, and I deliberately let them fall to the ground when I turned the pages. So then there was some silence and I had to pick the pages up, and I picked the pages up and I would put the wrong page and play just sort of whatever I could find with her. She did great. She just kept right on playing. But the thing that was really, really funny to me about that, and an example, let me just say this as an example of why I think my anti-Hindemith rule is a good one, even though I'm breaking it right now. It didn't honestly sound that much worse when I was playing the random part that wasn't what went with her than when it's actually the way the piece goes. Now, you can take that as a testament to his having, let's say, incredible motivic unity, or you can have it be that, you know, the piece should sound better when the piano part is playing on the same page as the clarinetist than it does when the piano part is playing on a different page. It probably sounded a little bit worse, but I thought it was really funny that it still sort of reasonably made sense. Anyway, that's my anti-Hindemith rant for the day. Okay, let me tell you about Chopin. Okay, so this Friday, which is the last day of classes, I'm going to be presenting a Friday faculty lunch, which is a thing we have in my school where, maybe I've told you about this before, I'm not sure, but where faculty get up and present for a lay audience, so for other faculty, what they're working on, like what their research is or what they work on. And it's a really, really cool thing because you get a chance to see what other people in, you know, the economics department or the biology department or the art department or the history department, what people are working on. Anyway, so I'm going to be talking about working on the Chopin Etudes. And it's become very, very clear to me when I've talked to people over the last several years, just my friends who are teaching in other departments on campus, that a lot of people don't really know exactly what goes into practicing. So I'm trying to try and explain that in 45 minutes. So one of the things that's been driving me nuts, this is why I'm spending so much time away from the piano and thinking so much about how can I be making myself a better pianist while being away from the piano, is I'm putting together this PowerPoint and I'm just not, you know, I am not great at PowerPoint, but all the like copying images and pasting and it's taking forever and it's frustrating. But I won't complain at you about that. I'll say instead that it makes me feel really lucky that I don't have to use PowerPoint more often. anyway, so one of the things that I'm doing for this that I thought might be interesting, and I just thought I'd walk you through this, and I'm actually about to start talking about Chopin, believe it or not, is I divided the etudes into sort of a taxonomy of the specific image, the specific issue that they mostly work on. Now, as you know, if you've played any of them, they all work on lots of different issues, but most of them have sort of one overarching kind of thing. Even though, or one or two. Anyway, so I made a little taxonomy. So I just thought I'd walk you through that. So they're the ones that are about having an open hand. Obviously 10-1. And I'll probably play about that much of that. And then of course 10-9 for the next one. For the left hand, I mean. And that wasn't great, but that's what it is today. And then, of course, 10 number 11, which I haven't been doing my mathy way as much this week, just because I've been doing snippets and PowerPoint and barely practicing and other stuff, and yeah. Anyway, but 10 number 11, which is this one. No, this starts here. There we go. And then, oh, the left hand of 25 number 5. So listen to the left hand. And then 25 number 3, especially in the left hand. And then, oh, and 25 number 1, not everywhere, but a lot of places. So those are kind of the main, I think, open hand ones. And then I'm calling this next category single hand multitasking, where basically one hand does two things at once. You could also think of them as places where it might be nice to have three hands. So they're, you know, sometimes it's easier, like 10 number 3. Seven, which one is 25-7? I'm looking at numbers and I'm not doing this with the music at all. Which one is 25? Oh, of course, this one. And then, then, of course, when it gets really crazy, like 10 number two. I'm going to leave that one there. 25 number six. Oh my goodness. I haven't really practiced. I'm going to probably have to show that one under tempo. 25 number eight. Which one is 25 number eight? Wow, I am just not functioning right now. That was 25 number eight. Sorry, that was 25 number eight. 25 number six is the thirds. This one, you know, of course. Number 10, which I can't do yet. Also, I haven't really practiced it. Where, what key are we in here? No. Oh, I'm making this up. Okay, well, I need to look at the music. I bet I'm making it up. No, it's here. We'll do it here. There it is. Right? So with these little middle notes. And then I guess that would also sort of count as an open hand one because you have to move around so much. But as you know, these they all address different ones together. And then 25-3, oh, which is this one again. Right? And also 10 number 7. And I wanted to say a thank you. I've been in a really wonderful email correspondence with a pianist who has played all of these etudes and has performed Opus 10 hundreds of times, who's been giving me really terrific suggestions, none of which I've had time to even apply at all. But it's been really fun to get some ideas from him. Anyway, he suggested for 10 number 7, practicing it as legato as possible in the top voice, but staccato in the bottom voice. For a few days and then switching, which I haven't done yet. But I did a couple of days of just a little bit of doing. And that was really fun, and I think it's going to work nicely. Anyway, so 10-7 is this one. That one. And then there's another one, I don't have a short, pithy title for this, but I'm saying fast lateral motion as an accompanimental figure. See, I told you it wasn't short. Which, of course, is 10 number 8. I can do that better. Let me do that again. So forth. I'm going to play that through for you actually in a little bit, but not yet. 10-12, of course, which is upside down, right? And then 10-4, which is both of them. And 10-5. So forth. 25-6. Oh, right. Let me try this again. You'll notice I just played it before. Yuck, let me actually pay attention to the melody. I won't play that much for them. I'll probably just play the first little bit. 25-11, which I totally can't play yet, but this one. that. I'll probably have to show them that one under tempo too. Or I'll practice it this week and see how it goes. And then the B section of 25-5, which is this stuff. That one. And then I have a category I'm calling tricky accent patterns, which includes 25 number 2. And then 10-10, which is the one that I have not yet figured out how to memorize. So if you have suggestions for how to memorize these accents, I'd love to hear them. Which is this one. I'm just making up. I don't know when it changes. Anyway, that one. 25 number 4, which is, oh, this one. Boy, I haven't been practicing this one in a while. We haven't gotten into the accent parts yet. Oops. Here we go. So forth. Oh, and then 25-5 with these guys. Ah! You can hear that I haven't been practicing it. Anyway, that one. And then there's a couple that I'm just calling flexible wrists, which are basically the two octave ones towards the end of 25-9. This guy. I guess you could also say it's sort of a shifting accent one. And then, of course, 25-10, which I've already noticed a couple times, but this guy, what did I say? It was B minor? Yeah. Ah! Let me try that again. Okay. So those are the little snippets of in my taxonomy. I'm going to show them. And then I'm going to try to talk to them about how I actually work on some of these things. And then I want to play two of them all the way through. So I'm going to play a couple for you now. I'm definitely going to play 10 number 3 because Chopin said it was the most beautiful melody he ever wrote. And so I think it would be nice to play that for them. And I am going to play it at 100. I don't know that I'm going to play it at 100 forever, but I do believe in sort of taking what the composer wrote as a starting point, even if it doesn't work. So I'm going to use this as an experiment and play it at 100, even though that feels faster than what I normally want to do and what I think most people normally want to do. And then the other piece I'm deciding between, I'm deciding between 10-5, 10-8, and 25-2. I'm going to play all three of those for you. And I am going to decide after I play those for you. Okay, I'm going to play all three and then I'll decide. And please know that none of them is where I want them, and I don't expect them to actually be where I want them by this performance, but I will talk to them about how this is very much in progress, and it'll be my first performance of these, so I think that's something to do. And by the way, I was going to do the Revolutionary Etude as my sort of other big performance, but I feel like I need to do something that is a challenge that I haven't performed before, because I have performed the Revolutionary Etude before, and I think I need to get more of these etudes into the category of I have played it before or have performed it before, even if I haven't performed it the way I want to yet, which I certainly haven't with Revolutionary Etude. So definitely going to do 10-3 and then deciding between 10-5, 10-8, and 25-2. Let me play all four of those for you right now. I'm going to do this from memory. It might not be pretty, so there might be, but you know what? I'm not going to yell or comment or anything. I'm just going to play through. But know that if things happen, I knew that they happened. Okay. I'm going to use my metronome for now to find 100 because it's not intuitive yet. So this is 100. I won't play with the metronome, so I'm going to start with 10-3. Okay, let's see how this goes. Say anything. Okay, I won't say anything anymore. So the middle section was a big ol' mess, and it kind of is written as a big ol' mess, but it shouldn't be that big a big ol' mess. So I need to really delve into that this week. Okay, so that's 10 number 3, which I'm definitely going to play, and then I'm deciding between 10-5, 10-8, and 25-2. So I'm going to play 10-8 for you. This is kind of my favorite one out of the three right now, but it also is the least ready in a way, but we'll see. Thank you. So the first couple of pages of that went pretty well. They felt pretty good. I'll see how they sound when I listen to the recording. Some of the transition points are really still, I have to put so much brain power towards. Like every time you do this, you either do this the first time or this the second time, which is this one goes to here, right? So it's sort of a five of five. It's not. But it feels like it makes sense. Anyway, I feel like I know okay, so I don't have a theory map that's working in terms of like obviously having the numbers and the Roman numerals in my mind, but I feel like I this is a 2-5. It's a 2-5, so it's not a 5-5. That's why it's not working as a 2. Anyway, that feels like it makes sense. But then the last one is, which I'm just thinking of, it's 5 in the right hand, or 5, here it's 5-5. But it's got this in there. So this one I'm just thinking of as the weird chord. So if I can remember, the first it's, that it's just 5-C, and then the second time it's this, a 2 going back to F, and then the last time it's the weird chord. Anyway, you can see that that's not fully ingrained yet. Then the other thing that's really tricky with the memory that's putting a lot of my attention towards, you know, what are the notes rather than how do I want to phrase this beautifully, are the last couple pages. All of this from here. This thing. First time goes. It goes up a C chord, right? So it's here. And then it's fine. And then we're up here. And then we go up a C chord, but we skip the G and we go up to here. Oops, sorry. So it goes here. But I still have to think about it a lot. And then the next time it goes, it doesn't do the whole chord. It just does C to E to C to E. Sorry, C, E, C, E. Ugh. Anyway, I have you can hear that there are just lots of places where I'm just not sure and have to put so much energy into the memory. So yeah, I just have to put a lot of energy into the memory. And but I think that once the memory is solid, I think this piece is going to be really satisfying to play. I mean, it already is satisfying to play. But I am looking forward to not having to work so hard for that little spot. Okay, so that's 10-8. That's sort of where 10-8 is right now. Let me play 10-5 for you. This sort of either is perfectly fine or a disaster, and it's kind of hard to know which is going to happen on any given day. Anyway, here's 10-5. Thank you.
it's sloppy and I think maybe kind of boring. The dynamics aren't as clear as they should be. I don't know. Anyway, all right, so that's another one. I also, of course, I know Chopin wasn't crazy about it himself. When he heard that Clara Schumann was playing it, he said, why is she playing that one? So I am also maybe prejudiced against it for that reason. Okay, let me play 25 number 2 for you. Yeah, here's 25 number 2. I haven't decided. I said I was going to decide. Okay, here's what I'm going to do. I am going to listen to this recording of those three, and I'm going to decide when to listen to the recording, and I will let you know next week which one I chose. I mean, this is why I'm glad I get to play them all, right? Because in a way, I feel like, oh, that there were some good things and some bad things. I want to do that one, but I want to. Anyway, I need to pick. So I'm going to decide after I listen, and then I will let you know. Okay, so that's what I've got for you this week. Three more podcasts, unless you write me those reviews. And if you want to hear the potty training song, let me know in those reviews as well. You can find out more about this project at playitagainspeak.com. You can write me a review on iTunes, which I may have mentioned. You could like my Facebook page, which I'd appreciate. Thank you so much for being my practice buddy.